Hello, and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, which has been bringing financial reporting, sustainability, audit, and risk teams together for years to help teams provide assured, integrated reporting. It's yesterday's crush, today's obsession, and tomorrow's addiction. My name is Catherine Tsai, professional asker of questions, and I like to drink venti soy chais. I'm here with Steve Soder. Steve, take it away.
Hello, everyone. My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. Looking forward to debiting a great conversation and debiting a brand new season of Off the Books. Season 7. Catherine, can you believe it?
I can't believe it. Season 7.
I know. It's crazy. Today, Catherine, we are talking about return to office. Lots of news about companies beginning 5 days a week in the office mandates. Amazon, AT&T, JP Morgan. I think AT&T was actually earlier, but a lot of companies talking about it. And I don't know, a lot of individuals and affected employees are talking about it too. Catherine, what are you hearing?
Well, even in the government, they're trying to get people to come back to the office too, right? With Elon Musk and his new office.
The Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, has called for federal employees to return to the office and dismiss those who refuse to return. I thought it was interesting. The House actually passed a bill to that effect, and they called it the Stopping Home Office Work's Unproductive Problems Act, or the Show Up Act. They must have like an acronym generator there.
I was just going to say.
I don't know who comes up with those. But you know, it's interesting, Catherine, when I think about certainly accounting and auditing, I certainly can't argue with the value of people being back in the office, those face-to-face conversations, those little interactions that, you know, you miss out on when everything you do is virtual on Zoom or Teams or Google. But I don't know, it just feels like that there's... it has been a little bit bumpy in getting people back to work, and I actually wonder, like, you know, what are the impacts on employees? You know, how are employees feeling about this? Candidly, it sounds like they're not feeling that great.
Yeah, and full disclosure, Steve and I both work for a company that has some pretty amazing offices, and at the same time, we have the option to work wherever we want. So that might color some of our perspectives, but what was your initial reaction to some of these companies calling people back to the office 5 days a week, Steve?
I don't know. I mean, I on the one hand, I understand as a company is looking at, you know, largely vacant commercial real estate, as they're thinking about the impact that on their culture and kind of what has happened since everybody went fully remote. I mean, I certainly don't blame companies for having that conversation. To me, it just seems a little bit baffling that they're taking as strong a stance. And I want to clarify, I do mean that for companies who could otherwise operate one way or the other. I mean, again, if, you know, like you work for a doctor's office, of course, which is obviously outside of the scope of this conversation, but just an example, you know, that's where you really need to be in the office. I mean, the question that I ask myself is, where are you going to get the very best from your employees? And I don't know, I'm wondering if these companies maybe have a pretty decided perspective that they're not getting their best when everybody is working from home or remotely.
Well, maybe we should run through some of the pros and cons of returning to the office. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think from my standpoint, I was appreciated giving employees that worked for me the opportunity to have some really good, valuable heads down time. I felt like that's when you could be creative. That's when you could have a little more control over the kind of work you were doing throughout the day. You know, some people may work best early in the day. Some people may work better later in the day or even late at night. You know, one of the things that I feel like can be difficult when you're in an office, especially an open air office environment, is to have that really deep, meaningful thinking time. So I could certainly see that being a pro, but a con could be that connectivity. You know, as you mentioned, Catherine, we get the opportunity to have some pretty amazing working location policies. But I will say that when we have the opportunity to get together as a team, when you and Mike and I are all recording in person, it's amazing, right? The interaction is different. The synergy is different. I mean, it just has a different feel to it. I do wonder if over time there might be like diminishing returns there when, I don't know, maybe I want to get a break from you and Mike.
Oh, what are you talking about?
I don't know. What do you think about it?
Well, I was looking actually at some public reports from companies, and Yelp is one company that went down to one office and everybody else is working remote. And they released a report that was saying in 2023, their office space reduction was expected to generate $26 million to $28 million in annual GAAP expense savings in 2023 and 2024. So that seems like a monetary or financial benefit from maybe allowing not everybody to have to work in the office.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know what's interesting about that? If I put my accounting lens on it, you know, if you think about just like how you make money at a company, right? You generate a whole bunch of revenue, then there's some cost associated with generating that revenue directly, and then you have a bunch of indirect costs, you know, general administrative, whatever. Again, not having known exactly how that number is calculated, the thing that's interesting to me, so $26 million, I don't know what Yelp's financial statements look like. That might be a relatively large or small number. But what's interesting is that $26 million worth of expense savings, if you actually work backwards and figure out like, okay, if I didn't make this change, in order for me to generate $26 million more of income, how much revenue would that take? And it would actually be a significantly higher number because, you know, that revenue is going to be burdened again by direct cost and so forth. That actually ends up being a fairly sizable number, a really sizable number. And it's interesting to me to think about a company saying, okay, you know what? What is going to be the benefit of me maximizing productivity if I think that's what's going to happen when I bring employees together? Or what's the value of getting rid of my commercial footprint and then maybe having to make other arrangements or other expenses when I do decide to get people together? I don't know. To me, that feels like a pretty smart choice, or at least an analysis. I'd be shocked if these larger companies aren't thinking about that, or at least somebody's not thinking about that. But I don't know. Again, we've got some very large companies that are mandating people to come back. And I don't know, maybe they just felt like whatever the numbers said, it was a cultural or a productivity or some other benefit that outweighed whatever those expense savings might be.
I wonder what some city economic officials would have to say about return to office. So if anyone's listening and they want to put in a comment, let us know what you think about whether employees should be going to an office or still working from home.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the other things that I had heard in some of these stories is that a return to office policy is actually kind of a clever way to encourage people to perhaps leave and go somewhere else without having to pay severance. You know, one of the things is if you're going to do like a broad reduction in force, you know, it's like, hey, we're going to cut 1% of our workforce or 5% or a certain number of employees. That's actually fairly expensive. You know, generally, you're going to pay severance for those roles. Those costs can kind of add up. But that's because those would be non-voluntary departures. If somebody says, hey, I don't want to go back to the office, so I'm going to find work somewhere else, that, of course, would be voluntary. And generally speaking, you don't pay severance. And candidly, the exposure, I guess, the negative consequences or pressure or optics to that, you know, are certainly different. And so, you know, people have talked about that happening. I have no opinion one way or the other, but it is interesting to see how that's going to play out. And you know, what actually happens to the number of heads at these companies as a result of these policies.
That got dark.
Well, I didn't mean to get dark, but I'm just telling you what I'm hearing.
Let's get a professional opinion. We are lucky enough to have Emily Forrester, who is the Chief People Officer at Workiva, joining us.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
So we're curious, what are the conversations that you and your peers in HR are having on this topic of returning to work or returning to the office?
Well, this is a topic that absolutely continues to evolve, as we all know. And there's a lot of curiosity amongst my peer group in terms of how companies are continuing to refine their approach and the policies that they have. The conversations I'm frequently involved in are really anchored around what are you doing and why. And I will say that I really appreciate the way that the HR community is coming together to share information and practices around return to office. There's a lot of camaraderie that feels like it's been established across the HR field over the last several years, especially. We've all been helping our organizations navigate some really heavy topics. And the degree of transparency that we're having with one another around best practices, how things are going, how things are not going, has been really invaluable, I think, for all of us to shape what we're doing within our organizations.
Emily, when you're having these conversations, who's generally involved? I mean, I imagine, first of all, you probably have a ton of opinions, but who do you find is weighing in with you know, maybe the most serious or relevant questions and perspectives. I'm assuming it's the C-suite, but how broad is that? What does that group look like?
Well, this is a topic that, of course, everyone has a perspective on, right? And it is important to navigate these conversations in a way that ensures that executive leadership and oftentimes the board of directors has a strong perspective that is being incorporated into the actual day-to-day. In my experience, though, the final decision does land with the CEO.
What are some of the issues that the C-suite is considering when they're trying to decide whether they should mandate a return to the office or not?
So I think one of the things that is absolutely on the front of the C-suite's mind is ensuring that there is a clear definition of what that policy could be and a sound explanation why. It's been interesting to see over the last several years how the measurable drivers behind return to office decisions are being evaluated and are being leveraged to make a really data-driven, well-informed decision. There's a lot of questions around what metrics are being evaluated and how will the data tell us whether this policy is going to be successful or is not going to be successful. And the strategy behind that then is important to make sure that it is going to be clearly articulated and understood across all of the stakeholders who are going to be impacted by this. In the conversations I've also had with other chief HR officers, there's been a lot of thought behind the risks, the benefits, and frankly, the unintended consequences that an organization needs to be prepared for, and thinking about how the metrics and indicators of success of a return to office play into all of that. Ultimately, at the end of the day, though, it comes down to being able to own that decision and clearly communicate it to your employees. Employees expect transparency from their employer, and they're going to ask a lot of questions about why a policy is made or not made. And this is a hot topic. Not everybody is going to be happy. But open communication is always the best way to bring people along on the journey with you. And that has been something that I think we've all learned is incredibly important to come from with a really solid tone from the top.
Emily, you read these stories of these larger companies that have mandated return to office policies, and some of them have been, I don't know, harrowing is probably a little bit of a strong word, but you know, you show up and all the desks are full, or there's no place to park, or you've got managers trying to figure out like, okay, how am I going to engage the team when we have like this massive like disruption happening? How would you advise team managers or even the C-suite who are trying to navigate what are really some difficult issues and complex issues for all the reasons that you've just told us about?
I think a lot of it comes down to really being comfortable with that why and being able to articulate the reason behind it. And with that, it cannot just be a very straightforward metrics only explanation why. It also has to come with empathy and understanding that everyone is going to be navigating this together, and that appreciation for the human impact of navigating whatever the policy is together, I think makes a big difference.
You mentioned some of the risks and benefits that you and your HR peers are discussing. Hypothetically, what are some of those risks and benefits of returning to the office?
Well, a lot of it'll depend on the industry, I suppose, but you think about productivity benefits, you think about retention of staff, talent attraction could have risks or benefits depending on what the approach is. There could be impacts to the demographics that are interested in remaining employed or coming to work for that organization, also based on whatever that decision is. That's something to think about. employees' sense of belonging within an organization can be impacted. Employee engagement, I could go on and on. There's a lot of things to think about that could go either way, depending on a myriad of different circumstances.
So what about a hybrid workplace? Is that a good idea, or is it just not making anybody happy?
That's an interesting way to think about it. It could also make everybody happy, too. It gets everybody a little bit of both sides of things. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I think it comes down to what the company, you know, what the company decides is the most important for them based on all of the different factors, the risks and the benefits, the unintended consequences, and just being prepared. I think an organization really has to look in the mirror and ask themselves about the why, how they're going to measure the impact of this, and be prepared for a lot of different situations so that they can get ahead of it to make it successful.
What does that say about a company's culture if, for example, the only way we can be productive is if we're all together in office? And I realize, you know, manufacturing or medical or whatever, I mean, those are things where obviously you have to be like there physically. But I just wonder, does that give any cultural insight into the organization to say, hey, we can't get anything done unless we all just get in a room and we all got to hash it out? I realize it's never quite that simple. And part of me wonders about the cultural implications or indicators that start to have these influences on the way that companies kind of, you know, handle these things one way or the other.
Absolutely. And I have strong opinions about that and have tried not to interject my perspective on some of those things and just remain factual. I do think that there are cultural implications. And again, that is something that a company really has to look at themselves in the mirror on and think about what that says, what that doesn't say, how their regular standard operating procedures, interaction expectations, collaboration standards are or are not woven into different things. And think about the message that return to office sends or does not send as a result.
Thanks to Emily, she gave us a lot of issues that we can consider as we look at whether people should be returning to the office or not. Any other final thoughts, Steve?
No final thoughts that are significantly different from what we talked about, but I do feel like that cultural question is a really, really good one. I mean, the way that I like to think about it is if you're a great employee, you know, like you are maximizing your productivity, your resume looks good, chances are you can probably go anywhere. So let's say you're at, you know, JP Morgan, one of those companies that has mandated their employees to go back to the office. Hey, you know what? If I don't want to do that, then I'm going to find a job somewhere else, and I probably could. So what does that say about the people who are left? And what I think about is, okay, you may be left with people who can't get a job somewhere else. Again, I don't mean to go dark again, but like that is a thought. Or maybe, hey, I'm really, really good and I'm actually competitive. And so the way that I am going to try to get ahead is to cooperate with this policy when I think maybe some of my like competitors might not. And so then do you actually end up having an accelerating effect on kind of like competition a little bit, like within the employee base? And again, maybe that's what some of these companies are looking for. Hey, we want people who want to be here. We want people who are willing to give up maybe some of the benefits and niceties of being able to work remotely. So maybe it's a cultural decision for them after all. I don't know. Either way, Catherine, I think it's been really interesting to see how it plays out, and appreciate Emily stopping by and sharing her perspectives. Now, Catherine, as we started recording here, we both actually realized we don't have a closing question, but it turns out my trusty Would You Rather card is coming in handy. So I have a question for you.
All right.
It's winter time, and although I know you like to snowboard, I have a question. Would you rather always have to wear one ski at all time or a 5-pound nostril piercing?
What? One ski.
Yeah, one
ski.
And it can't be a snowboard. But okay, you would go for the one ski?
I'll go for one ski. I can't imagine a 5-pound block on my nose.
Yeah, I'm with you. That sounds pretty painful. Much less painful than just having a ski on your leg. Oh, my goodness. Well, big thanks again to Emily Forrester for dropping by. And big thanks to you, dear listener, for surfing along with us. Me llamo Steve Soder. You just heard Catherine Tsai, and this has been Off the Books, presented by Workiva. Hey, please subscribe so you don't miss any of Season 7's episode, including our big reveal, we finally did it, of the best accounting movie of all time. And if you like Off the Books, please leave a review. Tell your buddies if you like the show. If you're watching this on YouTube, drop us a note in the comments, or feel free to drop us a line at offthebooks@workiva.com. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next one.